If you feel your child may have additional needs or are already embarking on the SEN journey, then this podcast is for you. Today's guest has been a teacher for more than 20 years, much of which has been spent working in special needs education. Following the birth of her son Alex, who has Down syndrome, Emma Pinnock set up a consultancy called Essential Education Group, based in Birmingham, offering families practical advice on navigating the SEN journey. Welcome back to Brummy Mummies. My name is Zoe Chamberlain. I'm a journalist, author and mum. I launched Brummy Mummies as a community for families to help people to connect both online and in person. My goal is to share with you ideas and tips from other parents on how to juggle family life. Emma says knowledge is power and connecting with others is vital. Today she is sharing some of that inside knowledge and personal experience to help you make sure you're getting the best support for your child. So let's get straight into talking to Emma. Hi, Emma. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Hi, nice to meet you. And thank you for having me on your podcast.
It's great to have you on board. It's just, I think it's such a difficult subject for parents. And it's just really good to have your kind of expert knowledge on this. And you've also got personal experience of it as well. So could you tell us a bit about your SEN journey with your son?
Yeah, so I always have a really balanced side to sharing my son's story. Because I've worked in the field for so long, I understand some of the real difficulties that families come up against. And, you know, thankfully, we haven't had major difficulties, but it's still a different life. It's still a very unique journey that we've had. So we didn't know that our little man was going to have Down syndrome. So he came into the world being a full surprise and continues to surprise us every day. And we basically had that news, and then we kind of had to get our head around what it felt like, what it meant. You know, as parents, we were both in very different places. After myself having 20 years in the SEND world, it kind of was, oh, okay, let's keep going. You know, this is going to be what it is, and we'll face whatever as we go along. And, you know, for my hubby, that was a very different experience for him. So we definitely walked a bit of a journey there in terms of our experience. But as he's developed really well. I think one of the main things I'm just really grateful for, which is why I do the work that I do, is knowledge. I think when you are put into a world that you didn't expect to be, and when you're put into something that's very unique for your experience, and you may not even know anybody else that's had that experience, knowledge is your best friend. And so I feel that that's been the strength for us, to be honest, having the knowledge. And that's really why I want to do what I want to do for others. So he's been very well health-wise, very grateful for that. He's got developmental needs with his speech, but he gets his point across very well. He knows how to share his thoughts with you. And as he's developing now, his speech is actually becoming much clearer to those who don't know him. He has managed a mainstream school for primary. We haven't got that picture in our mind yet for secondary. We're not sure where he'll be. But at this point, he is in a mainstream primary school, managing alongside his peers, socially, working at a level that's not age appropriate, but also keeping up at his own level, and finding the right environment has been key. Not necessarily a perfect environment, because that doesn't exist. Hopefully, if his school is listening, you're perfect. But but actually, the right environment for him has been really, really key. So me understanding his needs really early on and being as super critical as I can around what he would manage has helped me to make those decisions well, but also knowing the system has helped me to make those decisions well as well. So he has an EHCP as well.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. Yes. And that just makes such a difference, doesn't it? Having that knowledge, as you say, knowledge really is power, isn't it? And I think that's often the difficulty with this, that parents feel that they just don't know where to turn and what to do.
Most definitely.
What do you think, what would be your advice to parents who feel that maybe their child does have additional needs?
So if your child has what they can identify as a hidden need, something like ADHD or ASD, and you're not quite sure, there is lots of resources out there, but also be careful. You know, Doctor Search Engine is not always the best place to go, because you will get lots of information that will possibly confuse or maybe overwhelm you. It's about finding the right channels for information. There's lots of information out there, but sometimes you can get overwhelmed with the information that's online. Sometimes it's not accurate enough for your child. And so it's finding people in either your local area that, or maybe running a charity or a business that has clear knowledge that can really support you onto the right direction. I think that's really the best starting point, because I do find that a lot of parents get overwhelmed really quickly with the information that's out there at the moment. So find a space that has some authority in the area to be able to sit down, spend some time, go to a support class, say, you know, I'm not quite sure if my child has got this additional need, but I'm just here to gain some knowledge and see if that's where he or she fits. And that's the best way to start your journey. I think trying to consume too much information can be overwhelming for many.
Yes. And could you tell us a bit about the special needs journey? I mean, what's likely to happen after a family has asked for help?
So it depends upon the age of the child. If the child is preschool age or they're going to a setting, the best point to start is at the setting. Because when it comes to the needs of a child, let's take autism, for example, or ADHD, it can show up very different in different spaces. What I find is that parents kind of adapt their world around their child, which is what we all do. And so sometimes the need doesn't kind of surface in the same way at home. And so finding, you know, places that can kind of have those observations, be really clear about what they're seeing, that's really a great starting point. So even if it's your mother and baby group, and again, you've got really great support there, and you can say, you know, I'm seeing this, or it's the nursery, really start to kind of build up that evidence and that information around your child before you kind of want to go straight down the statutory route. Now, once that information is gathered and there's a clarity around what you're thinking, really it's about getting involved with the SENCO or the person that's in has control over the SEND in the setting that you're in, and having conversations there. Now, I'm not going to make this a perfect picture, because unfortunately at the moment it's not a perfect picture. So it doesn't just have this seamless journey anymore to straight to send, you know, the send person straight to EACP. That's not a seamless journey. But starting the conversation, being really open about viewpoints from everybody and being really clear on your evidence is definitely the best starting point. Once you've done that and you've got to your send process and you've gone through your paperwork and you're looking at that, it's a matter of waiting for the system to kind of catch up with you. And usually that's a really frustrating space for many. So when you hear, like, my child's not getting the HCP, they're not going to go into the right settings, that's a real worry for families. It's a really important worry. But I also try to, in my work, support them to understand how they can empower themselves between those times and what is it that they can do at home to ensure that their child is getting the best possible start in that way. Now, they're not experts as family, they're not experts, but it's just kind of giving them the right knowledge and the right focus for their child so that they don't get overwhelmed with the system. So I think it's making sure that you collect the best evidence possible. You get the right voices around the table, as they call it, the team around the child. You get the right information collated and you start the process. But at this point of the system, being really patient about what that means, because it can unfortunately take a lot longer than the 20 weeks it's meant to take.
Yes. Yeah. And what about if your child is older? You know, you were saying very early on mother and baby, but what about if your child's kind of towards the end of primary school, starting secondary school?
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's still the same general route. Again, having the evidence, kind of taking yourself back as well, because as parents, we kind of have a little bit of an intuition, or, you know, that might be slightly different. They're standing out from their peers. And if they're developing typically well, there's less worry. But then sometimes as age develops, things like ADHD and AS can become more prevalent for the individual as they grow up. They understand the world more. They may have sensory needs that have changed. So that might be a big point of change. So again, it's about creating an evidence pile, not just of that particular moment, but also of what you may have seen as they were growing up, but actually you just felt actually it was a developmental thing. So having a real clear picture again. The other thing I would say as well is if they're transferring from primary to secondary, being really clear about the primary school's view as well. Because what sometimes happens is that as they do that transfer, and if the secondary school then highlights actually there's a potential need here, you've got three cycles of evidence that the school has to go through. So three terms of the school going, okay, we've seen this and we've tried this, we've seen this and we've tried this, which obviously then delays the whole process for your child. So I always say to parents, if you've got any questions or concerns before your child leaves primary, collect some evidence then. So that can feed into that three term cycle.
Yeah.
Because that's really, really key to kind of ensure that things aren't held back. Unfortunately, that transition from primary to secondary school can be a big trigger for those who are just not showing as much of their autism or ADHD, and that secondary school when there's not this one teacher that they have to focus on and this one process that they have to go through and they have to do lots of multiple changes can be a real trigger for some children, and you find that that's a real strong point for a lot of parents. So ensuring that the primary school has given you some information is key.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
I know that you've just mentioned how it's really good to empower parents. And I think that's so important because sometimes you just feel quite helpless, don't you, really? From your experience, what has been the impact of a SEN diagnosis on the rest of the family?
I think I can share a story here. So I had one young man who started a setting that I was running, who had a diagnosis of autism, but his family didn't know how to tell him. And so he was with me for probably about two terms by that point. And I felt that this was actually what he needed to know. So I spoke to the parents and I said, I understand why you don't want him to know, but in my experience, a child with his understanding of the world, once they do know, it makes such a difference to them. So I worked with the family and we made a decision to share it with them. They asked me to tell him, which was a privilege. And so I did, and I shared it with him. And literally his whole world changed, his whole mannerisms changed, his emotions changed. Everything about this child changed instantly. The next day he came into school, he was just a completely different child. And, you know, that to me is the power of understanding a diagnosis. Because it's about understanding yourself. I think that's the best gift we can all give ourselves, by the way, that actually if we can understand ourselves, we can actually create the world that we want around ourselves. But sometimes we suppress certain sides of ourselves and it makes life a little bit difficult. And that's what happens with somebody who doesn't understand their diagnosis. There's a side of them that's being suppressed. There's a side of them that's not being understood. And actually, that's a really key thing. And that's the most empowering thing we can do for the child and then the family. Because once the family then understands what this diagnosis means for them, so it's not autism as this umbrella term, it's autism in your home. And what does it mean for you? That becomes one of the most empowering part of a family's journey, I believe.
Yes. Yeah. And I suppose part of that is recognising that every person is different, aren't they? I guess everyone's going to have autism or whatever it is in a different way, aren't they?
Definitely. And as you know, the saying is, you know, if you met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism. And that is so, so true. I've worked in this field now for close to 20 years. And I can't say that any child is exactly the same at all. The psychological theories that underlie autism, I can probably identify in all of them, but they present very differently. And it's about understanding that. And when I have conversations with organisations that are thinking about how do we ensure that people are well included, etc., I don't go down the route of, you know, make sure you've got quiet spaces, etc., which is all very important. I go down the route of relationships, because actually creating a space of genuine relationships and unique connections is what we all want, because that's what belonging is. And if organisations can do that successfully, they can support inclusion successfully. And that's a really key thing, I think.
Yeah, that's really good. It's really good to think of it like that. So what help is available for children and their families? And as we were just saying, as every child is different, how do you make sure your child's getting the support that's right for them?
Yeah, I think going back to one of my earlier points is finding the right spaces for the conversations. So the support groups that are connected to autism charities or ADHD groups or PDA groups, finding those spaces are really important, but also being really clear about what you're seeing at home is really important, because you get caught up in everybody's stories. It's part of what we do as humans. So we need to be really clear about our own story. And one of the ways to do that is to either get really clear assessments from schools, which again, I'm not trying to be idealistic here, because that's not always the case in every school. But making sure that, you know, if the school is recognising your child's needs, is making sure that they've got the right assessment. So has the EP been involved, the educational psychologist? Has the speech and language person been involved? Have you got the right levels of assessment and clarity about what's happening for your child? So if I was to use my son as an example, his speech has been his biggest area of need. And every speech and language person has signed him off. Now, in my knowledge, because of my knowledge, I knew it wasn't a cognitive need. His speech and language wasn't cognitive, because he could get a point across when he needed to, and still does. And he could understand things that we were sharing with him, asking him to do. So I knew that it wasn't a cognitive thinking thing that was stopping his speech. So it had to be something for me that was physiological. And when I got into the understanding of what that would have been, it was his muscle tone, because of Down syndrome impacting muscle tone. Now, I could have been focused on flashcards and information, which can be the speech and language approach, but actually that's not what my son needed. So it's about being really clear about what is it that your child needs from all of these different disciplines. And that's going to help you to move the dial for your child each and every time. So going back to that original question, it's about getting the right professionals in line to assess well and to assess clearly and really pinpoint what your child needs. If you're not getting that from your school, your provision, it's to consider private. Now, I know that's not a luxury for everybody, but it's to consider private and consider getting those assessments done privately. So again, you can pinpoint what's happening for your child. And not going for the global need, it's speech and language. Now, actually, it may just be muscle tone. And so creating a clear plan of support there is really important. So it's go down the route of school, go down the route of private, and get really well researched. That would be the starting point for me in terms of getting that support. But it is about looking out for the right places in your local areas and, you know, searching companies, et cetera, that do that type of work.
Why do you think it is quite a lottery for parents? You know, some people do find it really difficult to access the right support. Why is that the case in some settings and then maybe not in others?
I think it's a knowledge gap. I do. I think, you know, education, I love education, it's my world. And as teachers, we're trained to teach a wide, especially primary teachers, a wide range of subjects. But as all humans, we're all drawn to certain things. So some people are really heavily drawn to literacy, some maths, if you're a wild person like me, psychology. So psychology was my degree. Psychology was my starting point. And so for me, going into a classroom, it was very much like, why is there barriers to learning? Which isn't naturally what happens for every teacher. And because at the moment, training for early career teachers now, it's not NQTs, early career teachers now, doesn't really focus heavily enough on SEND and the differences of learning and the psychology of learning. That it means that only people that really push the interest are going to be really great in that space because it's not a real focus. It's getting better though. It's getting much better. And so I think that's been the reason why there's been a bit of a lottery. And I think in terms of the actual, again, this is getting better, which is great, based upon what's just been, which has just been shared with from the government, this is going to get better. But the SENCO role originally has been a bit of an administration role. So it's been a bit of finding out what the need is, getting the paper work done and getting that to the right through the right systems. And then hopefully there's some help at the other end. Well, actually, the SENCO role is evolving to actually being a bit more specialist, being clearer about what the need actually means and how do we apply this into the classroom. And I think that's the journey that's been needed. But unfortunately, as that journey has been happening, it's been leaving gaps in the system.
It's really interesting. On the podcast, I interviewed Kate Griggs, who's the lady who founded Made by Dyslexia.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she has this massive program that she's trying to put into all schools with Microsoft, saying that, you know, every child should be taught the way that we teach dyslexic children, that actually all children will benefit in that way, yeah. Which I think is fascinating to kind of like turn it around on its head, really, isn't it? To say, let's teach all the kids the way that we would teach perhaps this branch of SEND children, rather than perhaps taking them away and treating them differently.
Completely agree with her. And I'm completely on the same tech page, so it's going to be the autism side for me. But actually, I feel exactly the same, because when we dissect learning and we dissect the things that children find the most challenging, it's actually really clear in dyslexia and autism. And so it's about understanding, as I said, the psychology of learning, and getting onto that pedagogy just that little bit more, because at the moment the pedagogy is basically focused on the typical learner, which is great. And, you know, majority of schools have got the majority of typical learners, but actually it's for those children that just need that different approach. And there's just so many small tweaks that can happen. So for an example, some people on the autistic spectrum find imagination quite difficult. And so reading a book and we ask that child to imagine is going to be very, very difficult. You're going to ask them to imagine the character, ask them to imagine this. So actually we have to build in the skills of imagination, and we have to make that part of a process to support somebody to imagine what a text is actually saying to them. And I think it's these bits of pedagogy that can be really missing that can help all children, because actually some children's imagination is just not as strong as others, to develop different types of approaches to learning. So I'm completely on board with her on that. Then yeah. If we get more of those strategies in place for all children, then that's going to make a massive difference.
More than the kind of rote learning and remembering. Yeah, yes.
And I think it's moving. It's changing.
Yes, that's good. So what support is available to help, say, siblings, parents and grandparents come to terms with a child's needs and the impact this has on their lives?
So I know there's lots of charities that do a lot of work around sibling work and sibling support, mostly siblings more than extended family. But there's definitely lots of charities out there that do that. Can I mention them?
Yes, please do. No, the idea with this podcast is that it helps people as much as possible. So, yeah, any signposts that you can give us would be really helpful.
Great stuff. So the Signet, you know, that training course does support families to understand the sibling point of view. There's charities like Bernardo's. There's charities like Family Fund, who I'm a trustee of as well. They do some great work there. around siblings. And so it's finding again those companies and going out there and just searching what's out there. Part of my company as well, I do a family coaching course, and I do include all of the extended family on that, because it's about increasing the conversation in families. I feel when families do come to me and it's a bit of a difficult space, the communication has changed, or the communication has been difficult. And so it's about creating a space for communication. So one of the things that I do on the family coaching course is around getting families to think about what they're really deep down thinking and feeling as well. Again, from our own experience, myself and my husband felt very different things around my son. And that did impact our communication at that point. So it's about creating spaces where communication can be opened again and flowing again. And what I do hear from a lot of families is that actually extended family don't understand my child. They don't understand the behaviours. They may have a old school approach to, you know, behaviour management and just saying this has got to be this way. And actually just opening the conversation of that actually that behaviour may be connected to a sensory need. That behaviour may be because actually they're not connecting to all the language that you're sharing. And so it's taking them longer to, you know, to follow instruction or to respond to you. And that might be really frustrating, but actually that comes from this point. And I feel that that just makes a massive difference to a family if they can understand why they see these behaviours, you know, and where they're coming from. So again, that knowledge is key.
Yes. And do you think that's really important to be open and talking about it as a family rather than perhaps hiding it away?
Definitely. I think it's the more open you can be, the better, because everybody's needs start to get can shrink a little bit when there's a child who has an additional need, especially if it's a very demanding additional need. And so everybody's needs can kind of get circulated around this child and their needs, and rightly so. But then what happens is that other people's needs in the family can start to be pushed aside. And so it's about creating really open communication so that everybody's needs can come to the surface, you know. And sometimes those conversations are really uncomfortable, and sometimes those conversations aren't what we want to hear. But sometimes they have to happen so that the flow of communication can move a little bit more. And as I said, from my family coach course, that's what we try to achieve with people, to kind of just support that communication a bit more.
Had you already set out your consultancy before you had Alex, your son?
No,
or was it
I hadn't.
Afterwards? Is that the reason why you wanted to set it up?
Yes and no. So I feel that on maternity, I think a lot of mothers have the moment like, oh my goodness, I'm going back to work. But I absolutely loved my job. I loved what I was doing. At the time, I was running an autism resource base plus other things. So I loved my job. So I was happy to go back. But on maternity, you have those little niggling things about, you know, do I really want to go back? And so I did go back, and he went to nursery at 10 months. So again, managed well in a mainstream nursery. Again, all this was on assessment, because he could have been a different child and might have had to look at it differently, but this was all on assessment of him and he was fine. So I went back. And then when you're in the system, you can kind of see how the system isn't supporting. And again, my consciousness of knowing how knowledge has helped had helped me to that point, and always seeing these families coming to me knowing that that knowledge had been escaped from them was really hard. So it was kind of that was part of the pull around how can I support other families to not feel as disempowered as I'm feeling that they're feeling. How can I do that? So obviously I was doing that through my work anyway. And as life changes and circumstances change and, you know, the demands of parenting change. So I wouldn't say it's because my son had Downs that the demands of parenting changed. The demands of parenting changed, and my job was quite demanding anyway. So then it started to push me in that feeling of, okay, what else could I actually do? Plus other factors added to that, and it just ended up being the right decision at the right time. So yes, he was a massive part of that, in the sense of I wanted to be really present for him. I wanted to be able to make sure that if he ended up at a special school, I could get him there, I could be there. I didn't want it to be too removed from him. And one of the other things was I've got the knowledge some of the knowledge that I think my son needs. And actually I'm putting him in, potentially putting him in a setting that doesn't. How do I make sure that I'm getting, he's getting the best of me? And that wasn't possible with the job that I had either. So that was, he was part of that, but also the changing landscape, the feeling that there was just not enough resources out there, the feeling that it was taking so long for people to get answers was another thing that added to my decision.
So how do you help families in a way that's different to what's available through the government?
And I do try to be really conscious of that. You know, when people connect with me, they are usually saying, I've got this EHCP, I need someone to look over it. And I try to keep out of that type of work. Like, you know, I will do that pro bono sometimes, because I feel that that should be statutory. And so the work that I do is very much around what's happening for you as a family unit. Where's your knowledge level? How can I support you to get the right knowledge for your child and not actually just give you a generic response? And so that's how I try to be different to what the system is offering right now. So through the screening work that I do, again, I pinpoint the need. So again, speech and language, is it global speech and language? Is it something more specific? When we're looking at sensory needs, is it that all the sensory needs are off, or actually is it something like the hidden sensory needs like proprioception? And if it's proprioception, what can we do? And so I try to pinpoint more specifically what the families need to be looking at so that they can get an action plan, a really clear one, because actually needs can be really wide. And then I, and from that, it's also the emotional and the additional support around the family coaching that I do believe is different to anything else that's out there.
Yes. So how has the way that you help families and also having your son setting up your consultancy, how's that changed your outlook on life?
It's an interesting one that I think what one thing that I really felt comforted by is that I was saying the right things to parents all these years, because obviously I didn't have those experiences myself. And obviously being a professional, you always are conscious if you're supporting people well. And so actually having my own son and having my own feelings about it felt okay. I haven't been too far off the mark over these years. It's been okay. So that's been one thing that it's, you know, it's given me the confidence around what I'm doing as well to feel that. But I think your outlook on life changes automatically as a parent anyway. I think as mums, we have this sudden change, this new birth after we have a little person. And so you see the world in a very clearer place, but also you also recognise that the way you create the world has to be different because your child is different. So you can't just have the same view of the future. You have to be flexible. And that's one of the other things I think that sometimes can be so hard for families, that they've had a dream and it's a right dream and it's their plan for their life, and all of a sudden it might have to change. And I think that's been one of my growth points of flexibility. And I think my other growth point has been vulnerability. Very self-reliant person, usually. And so having a child with additional needs, you have to reflect on what you need and how you're going to get those needs supported. So I think my biggest journey has been about vulnerability and flexibility.
Yes. Yeah. And as part of that, that as a parent with a child with additional needs, that you shouldn't struggle on your own, that you should reach out and get help
most
from other
definitely.
People.
Most definitely. And when you don't know, you don't know. And, you know, and when you, as I said, for myself, such a self-reliant person anyway, reaching out to people for help has not been the easiest start of this journey. It's been about that reflection for me, but such a better person, such a more reflective person on the world as a result of having my son, most definitely.
Yes. So what improvements would you like to see in the way that send education is handled in state schools?
You might need another hour. I have lots of thoughts on this one. But to be honest, just some more standardised approaches. I think the announcement this last week around SEND provision and alternative provision has been a massive, great step in the right direction. So being a part of the Green Paper analysis has seen, you know, where the government wants to take this. And I think it's actually a much better place. Some things need tweaking, but that's policy. So I think for me at the moment, it would definitely be training for teachers. The training level is just not strong enough. If I was to take a typical year, teachers will have CPD, continual professional development, and something like literacy and maths at least 4 or 5 times in different ways. And that's the formal. And then the informal would be the conversations they're having with peers all the time. That's not the same for SEND. It can be once a year, if that, for so many places. So I feel that SEND needs to become part of the professional conversation for teachers, which is why I also have accredited courses. And when I do my consultancy, I'm in having these professional conversations. So it's not just being trained and then I'm gone. It's basically being trained and I'm staying with you to develop this practice. And so it's about creating those conversations as much as we create conversations around literacy and maths. That would be a really key thing in terms of the standardisation, upping the knowledge for teachers.
So part of that be for every teacher to be trained in how to spot the signs of it rather than it just being kind of one teacher that the child goes to after lots of asks and cries for help?
Exactly. Most definitely. Identification is really, really key. And again, looking at the plans, that's looking like a big key area that's coming up, which is fantastic, but identification is key. And whenever I coach SENCOs, so whenever I'm coaching SENCOs, I'm saying, okay, what is your identification process? What do you do? And that's always the area that they find most difficult. Mm. Because what happens really is a child gets either very sparky or they're not making progress in the learning, and that's when they flag up. When actually there's so many more subtle signs before any of that happens. And so that's one of the key areas I do work with SENCOs on a lot. Okay, let's go and look into your early years. Let's go and find out who we may be missing and why. Now, when I do this work, this is not about leading a child to diagnosis, because not every child needs a diagnosis, but actually it's about recognising that in your school community, these needs are here, and now you need to upskill your staff to ensure that these children get the best possible support, because that may actually circumvent a diagnosis. It may actually stop a potential diagnosis going forward if the right support is in place. And that's why they talk about early intervention being really key. And so it's about recognising as much as possible in the early years, but all the way through education, where the needs might be. So the schools that pull me into early years, I'm really excited about.
That's really interesting. So if because I've heard that in schools before, that, you know, well, it's really not worth you having a formal diagnosis because we'll probably treat you in the same way, you know, give you extra time in exams, let you use a laptop or whatever the additional provisions are in. So by that rationale, how important is it to have a diagnosis?
I think it depends upon the prevalence and impact of the need. Mm-hmm. So I also support adults. That's not the main part of my work. So sometimes adults will come to me and say, Emma, I need a screening. I feel that I might be, you know, neurodistinct. And I feel that that has possibly been the type of child who's managed academically, have got on, but they've got older and they can see that their relationships are being impacted, etc. And I think at that point, knowledge is so, so key. Was it helpful beforehand? Maybe. But actually, you've got to this point and now the knowledge is key. Now you need to know what's happening. So I think it's knowing the prevalence and the impact of the need is where the diagnosis comes in for me. So when I say that early intervention works and supports, it's about how can we ensure that if a child, say, has sensory needs or a child has processing needs, how can we support that at the earliest point to ensure that it doesn't get so big that actually now a diagnosis is pertinent and it has to happen? A diagnosis should be information, not a crisis response. And I think it can be a crisis response at this time.
That's been so useful. We have a series of questions that we ask all of our guests, so I'd like to fire them at you if that's okay.
Go for it.
So what would be the two things you would tell your 18-year-old self if you had the chance?
Oh, this is a big one. just keep going, because there's times in my life that, you know, I've had big experiences, but just keep going. It always gets better. And just continue to take your risks. I think I've been a bit risk reverse as I was younger. Getting older now, I'm just more risk taking. So just take more risks. That's probably what I would say.
And what are three things that you love to do every day? What's your kind of morning, evening, what gives you a good routine to the day?
So I've realised that I haven't got a good routine. So when I thought about this question, so basically my son is my routine in the morning. He's up, he's full of energy, he's straight, and I'm just dragging myself out of bed. So my morning routine is not the best. But what I will say is that I have certain things across the week that are non-negotiables for me. And at the end of each day, it's about just a bit of self-care. So a bit of skincare, a bit of music, a podcast, something like that near the end of the day, but always a bit of just self-care at the end of the day. My relaxation comes at that point. And across the week, it's always Pilates. I go to Pilates, I ensure that's one thing that I do. And I touch base with special people that just fill my cup. So these are the things that I try to do throughout the week, but my days can be whatever they may be. So I don't think I have any kind of routine throughout the day.
That's the flexibility that you talked about earlier. Yes.
It is, yes.
So what would be the one piece of advice that you would give to somebody starting their Zen journey with their child?
Be open, be optimistic, and be clear on what your journey is. Because everybody's journey is very different. And I think use it as an opportunity to recreate what the next steps are going to be. Create something for you and your family. Create something in your space. And just feel flexible. That's what I would say.
That's really helpful. Thank you so much. I think that it's going to make a big difference to parents. It's just feeling that you're not alone with it, really, isn't it? That's so important with all of this.
Most definitely. Connect to the right people and, you know, just understand that your journey is unique, but it can always also be very special.
You can read all of Emma's tips on our Brummie Mummies Facebook page and on the Birmingham Live website. And you can find out more by visiting Emma's website, emmapinnock.co.uk. Please share this episode with anyone you think might find it useful. You may also want to check out our episode with Kate Griggs from Made by Dyslexia too. See you next time.